The Roll Up Yonder. The instant Dad's foot came off the accelerator, I knew something was wrong. I was in the middle of the back seat, exchanging little moron jokes with Rusty. On my left, my sister Ruth had her face in a book. I jerked my head up to see a long-nosed, wine-colored car bearing down, a wedge of dust marking its trajectory, like contrails behind a B-47 Stratojet. On my feet now, and looking between Mom and Mrs. Greeley, I knew the approaching driver was either nervous or drunk. He was braking, and from the way his car swayed, it looked like it would fishtail at any second. I should have been bracing, but my 9-year-old male brain was busy taking in the wide, chrome-plated harmonica grille of the charging vehicle, which I identified immediately as a brand-new 1950 Chrysler. Not only did I recognize the brand, but I could swear I'd seen this very car before. Ruth had dropped her book and was fumbling for the strap that hung above the door. Earlier, she and I had been fighting for the window seat, but she got it because she was bigger and subject to pouty fits, something Mom and Dad didn't relish on the long 2-day drive from Toronto back to Hearst. Mom brought her fingers to her mouth. "Careful, Charles," she said. I could see Dad strangling the steering wheel as he began pumping the brakes.
"It's okay, Winifred. I've got it. Can't brake too fast in this loose gravel."
Mrs. Greeley clutched the armrest on the front passenger door, while Rusty craned his neck to see around her gray hair that stuck out in tufts above her ears now that her trademark hat was sitting in the rear window. Yesterday, we'd picked her up at her daughter's in Toronto, and all day I'd worried about sleeping arrangements at the stopover point, North Bay, haunted by the prospect of glimpses of her chubby alabaster bowed legs as she raced to the bathroom. Mrs. Greeley was so bow-legged she swayed like a metronome when she walked. She came to town once a week and did all her hardware shopping at our store. In return, she got a ride back to the log cabin she shared with her husband Harrison, 2 miles to the west. She never strayed far from the store. Dad would provide a chair and she'd spend happy hours visiting with customers. When she did leave, it was seldom to go far. Across the street to the drugstore, perhaps, or down to get her mail. If she was not there when our employee, Mr. Larstone, was ready to drive her home, he'd only to look down the block, and there she'd be, smiling her way up the street, her flowered hat rocking 10 degrees to either side of vertical as she waddled past Tarafenko's, Bubnik's Taxi, and the bank. Inevitably, there'd be men standing outside the Palace Hotel across the street watching her progress, and inevitably they'd be humming, "Did you ever go swimming with bow-legged women and dive between their legs?" The Chrysler hurtling at us was closing the gap, but Dad managed to cut our speed enough to risk edging our 12-year-old 1938 Oldsmobile off the packed tire trails to the loose gravel on the shoulder. I watched him reach for the stick shift at Mom's knees and felt my body slam into the back of the front seat as the transmission engaged the lower gear. At my feet, I detected something hard. The cookie tin with the sandwiches had slid off the seat and upset on the floor. The smell of salmon and chopped egg wafted up from my stocking toes, but with the Chrysler almost upon us, no one noticed. Just at the point where the oncoming car aligned with us, 4 arms shot accusingly out the windows, gesturing wildly. Then they were by, and Dad was nosing us back onto the highway. For a second, no one spoke, shocked that in the opposing car they should hold us responsible for not giving ground. Suddenly it struck me why the car had seemed familiar. "It's the McNees!" I shouted, proud to be the one to recognize them. I cranked my head around to see the car stopping and people scrambling out. They began waving frantically in huge swooping movements, just like Virginia Mayo had waved to Gregory Peck as his ship sailed away in Captain Hornblower. Dad stopped, opened the door, and squinting into the dust, began backing up.
"Hurry up,"
I said to Rusty when the car halted, but he sat tight, looking straight ahead like someone who sensed trouble and had no intention of rushing into it. I reached for Ruth's door. She slapped my hand and calmly patted her hair as if she were getting ready for a teen town dance at the church manse.
"She won't let me out, Mom," I shouted, crossing my arms and throwing myself into the seat.
But Mom was having her own troubles getting out. Mrs. Greeley was on the ditch side of the road, and with the car listing at a 30-degree angle over it, her door had flown open the instant she touched the handle. Now she sat transfixed by the bottomless cavern that separated her short legs from the ground. In frustration, Mom had swung her dress and legs over the gear shift and was fighting her way uphill to exit the driver's side. Dad was holding the door so it wouldn't slam on her and looking around to see that no one witnessed her immodest evacuation. The McNee car turned out to be as full as ours, 6 people. Fully understandable in a small northern Ontario town where one whisper that your car was headed south out of the bush had potential occupants appearing like black flies on a fishing trip. 3 McNees exited the front seat. Father, mother, daughter. Three Joneses the rear. Mother, daughter, son. I whooped at the sight of Casey, who was 2 years my senior and the one person in the whole world I most wanted to be. We bunched into three scrums, parents, daughters, sons. When Mrs. Greeley finally managed to get her short legs into the sloping ditch, she didn't know which group to approach. She took a hesitant step, then stopped, her eyes dashing from one clique to the next. "Mr. Greeley had a heart attack," Casey said when we were out of earshot. "Is he okay?" I asked. "No, stupid, he's dead. Your parents have to tell her." The three of us glanced at Mrs. Greeley, who smiled at us as Casey talked on. "We've been on the lookout for you all day, but we didn't expect to meet up with you this soon."
"We made good time," I said. "Highway 11's paved all the way from Toronto to New Liskeard, and Dad was really pouring it on."
Casey sneered. "Your old man pouring it on? I doubt that. What was he doing? 40? I searched my brain for a new topic, but these were our last words, because the others were converging on Mrs. Greeley, and we didn't want to miss anything. When we reached them, they were drowning her in small talk.
"How was your daughter? What was Toronto like? Did you get rain?"
She looked from questioner to questioner with a slight frown. We shifted our weight.
"Be nice to get home," she said.
We looked away.
"Harrison's been working on the wood supply. I should be there to help."
Eyes sought eyes. Dad fumbled for his watch. "Well, we have to get moving to make Hearst tonight," he said.
"How are the roads?"
Six people from the McNee car jumped to answer. No one conversed for an eternity after we got underway. My folks tried small talk, but it fell flat.
"What time is it, Rusty?"
I whispered into his ear.
10 minutes past the last time you asked. When's someone gonna say something?"
Rusty shrugged. In the front, Mom cleared her throat. I stiffened.
"Where was Harrison from?" she asked. "What happened to his dad?"
Mrs. Greeley's answers didn't register with me because I was anticipating Mom's next sentence. But the conversation drifted to other matters. I slumped into the cushiony velvet of the back seat.
"I thought she was going to tell her this time," I said to Rusty, giving him a poke.
He poked me back.
"If you think it's so easy, you tell her." "Me? I wouldn't know what to say." "Exactly. So why don't you just shut up?"
"Anybody hungry?" Dad asked.
"How about getting a sandwich at the train station in Swastika?"
"Aw, Dad," I grumbled. "They don't have shakes there."
"There'll be no milkshakes today," Dad said.
"Why? We always..."
Dad glared at me in the rearview mirror.
"Grow up," Ruth said.
After our meal, the miles droned on, but still not a word to Mrs. Greeley. We drove into Matheson for gas, passing a BA station and a White Rose, but they wouldn't do. Our car ran on nothing but Imperial. Outside town, the sign read, Hearst, 190 miles. I groaned. We would never get home. I flipped through my comic books, Little Lulu, Combat Kelly, Ozark Ike, but I'd read them all. I crossed my arms.
"Everyone else has a radio in their car," I announced.
Dad gave his usual response. "Radios distract the driver.
Besides, with a radio blaring, nobody sings."
But singing was not what I had in mind. Listening to Fibber McGee and Molly or Boston Blackie, now that was something. And what did he mean, sing? All we ever sang were dumb hymns.
I turned to Rusty. "Know any riddles?"
"Nope."
"Want to play Hardy Knuckles?"
"Nope."
"How about you, Ruth? Want to play I Spy?"
She glared at me and pushed her body closer to the door.
"I'll play," Rusty said. "I spy something that is yellow."
"I got it,"
I shouted. "The poplar trees changing color, right?"
"Nope."
"Has to be."
I turned to face him, but he was gesturing wildly to the front seat with his chin.
"Has Harrison been well?"
Mom was saying. Dad placed both hands on the steering wheel, his chin dropped.
"Not even a cold,"
Mrs. Greeley said with a grin.
"No shortness of breath or chest pains?"
Beside me, I felt Ruth quiver as her finger shot down to her place in the book and her head came up.
"Never complains," Mrs. Greeley said. "Not in his nature."
She turned her head to look at Mom, the smile beginning to recede. The sun dropped behind the trees. A shadow crossed her face.
"He's a hard worker. A good man, my Harrison."
Mom draped her arm gently over Mrs. Greeley's shoulders.
"He's gone," she said.
The purring sound from the motor filled the car.
"Gone? Where?"
"Home to Jesus,"
The Lord has taken him.
But...
heart attack. It was over so fast, they say he felt no pain. Mrs. Greeley's head tipped onto Mother's shoulder. She quaked as Mom stroked her gray hair. I slid back in my seat. Ruth was wiping her eyes, Rusty holding his breath. Dad sped up. Stones flew under the car, pinging off the muffler and oil pan. I wanted to say something to lighten her burden, but could think of nothing. We passed through Cochrane in silence, except for Mrs. Greeley's sobs. Dad switched on the headlights. Then about Hunta, her head came off Mother's shoulder.
"Could we sing a hymn?" she asked, in a thin voice.
"Of course," Mom answered. "What would you like?"
"The Roll Up Yonder."
Dad led off. We sang it once, twice, three times. I sang with a fervor I'd never known, the words resounding in my mind like I was seeing them for the first time. Our chorale continued unabated through smooth rock falls. Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, "The Old Rugged Cross, 90 and 9. Mrs. Greeley mouthed the words more than sang. But by Kappa's gazing, with her no longer clinging to Mom like a swimmer in trouble, it was evident she was beginning to rally. We renewed our efforts. "The strife is over, the battle won. Breathe on me, breath of God. Rock of ages, cleft for me." With each mile that took us closer to Hearst, the hymns continued to roll off our tongues and work their magic. By Opus Attica, grim determination had outmuscled defeat. Mrs. Greeley's voice was stronger, her head up, her eyes focused on the dark road ahead. Shortly after Matisse, with our repertoire exhausted and our destination near, our hymn sing reached its finale with Dad's all-time favorite, "The Day Thou Gavest, Lord, is Ended." With the last note sung, the hum of the motor and the whirring crunching of tires on gravel reclaimed the car. If no one spoke, it was because there was no longer a need for conversation. We had communicated through our hymns, and it occurred to me that what we were experiencing might be what the minister called fellowship. It was a term he used often in those long Sunday night church services I was forced to sit through, but one I never really understood before. Was it fellowship because we knew the same songs and went to the same church? I wasn't sure. But I had felt a rare closeness in the car and knew that somehow we had stood by Mrs. Greeley and in a small way had helped her through her darkest moment.